Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Jacob Shapiro Podcast. Unless you're living under a rock, you know the reason that we're here. We're here for an emergency episode on the U.S. attack on Venezuela and the detainment of Nicolas Maduro and his wife, bringing them to the United States to face charges of narco trafficking, guns, whatever the U.S. government wants to make up to charge them with crimes. Marco Papich and I just recorded an hour plus long episode on this on Geopolitical Cousins. So if you don't listen to Geopolitical Cousins, you can head on over there. And if you want to hear our banter, I was trying to get a guest to come on my show with me. Ela was unfortunately busy, but he and I are going to do another episode in the next couple of days to take a step back and talk about what this means. But I wanted to come to you just solo for maybe 20 minutes and talk about what's going on here, what this means, and where I think things are going forward. The U.S. has been building the momentum for the strike, and you can see it over the last couple of months, really since July. The Trump administration came into office saying that it wanted to make a deal with Venezuela. A special negotiator was appointed to negotiate with the Maduro regime, and it sounds like the Maduro regime was basically ready to give the United States everything that it wanted. And in July, it all fell through. And it seemed to fall through, I think, because Marco Rubio was ascendant within the administration, and he was able to convince President Trump that he didn't want to make a deal with Maduro, that really what he wanted was to make an example out of Maduro. Now, Rubio has his own reasons for this. He has a mythos around him of, you know, his family fleeing the Cuban Revolution. When he was asked about Cuba in a press conference today, January 3rd, he said that those in Havana should be quaking in their boots. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he said, and we will get to that in just a moment. But since July, there's been a clear shift from the Trump administration away from negotiation and to this eventuality. And they built up the case. They declared the Venezuelan regime basically a drug cartel. They talked, they started firing on these boats in the Caribbean. They created this case where this isn't war for them. This is, no, they're going and they're getting a dictator and bringing him to the United States to face crimes. And if you are somebody who thinks this is strange for the United States has done this before. We did it to Panama in 1989, and it was actually much tougher than this. That's the first thing I want to underscore here. The United States flew in a couple of helicopters into Caracas, got the leader of the Venezuelan government, and flew him out. That only happens if Venezuela was ready to give him up. Venezuela is armed, I won't say to the teeth, but is significantly armed with Russian anti-aircraft weapons, Russian fighter jets. There would have been at least a couple of shots fired. There would have been some resistance if the Venezuelan regime didn't want to give Maduro up. Seems to me maybe a couple shots were fired, but at least according to the reports that we have now, there were no American casualties. This was way too easy. So I think Venezuela was giving up the game. Also note that the Trump administration is not coming in and appointing the Nobel Peace Prize winning Venezuelan dissident as the next president of the country. They're not even promising elections. President Trump himself said, and I'll paraphrase him, but basically that the U.S. is going to run the country for some indeterminate amount of time until there can be some kind of quote-unquote legitimate transition. And in the meantime, the United States is also going to be focusing on that Venezuelan oil, rebuilding that Venezuelan oil infrastructure. President Trump even said that this campaign would pay for itself because of all the Venezuelan oil riches that the United States will be taking advantage of. It's not going to be that easy. Venezuelan oil infrastructure is decrepit. It hasn't been well maintained. It's very sour. Yes, they have lots of reserves, but this is not like Saudi Arabia where it's just coming out of the ground and it's super easy. It's going to be harder to do than before. You can say that Guyana, which is right next door and had a fairy tale oil discovery of its own in 2017, they no longer have to worry about Venezuela threatening them. So if you're a U.S. energy company that's in Guyana, suddenly you remove some uncertainty there. And yes, you get some long-term access to Venezuelan potential there going forward. Also, you have to think that the Venezuelan military or the current regime is going to work with the United States here, that they're purging Maduro, but that these folks are going to stay in power, or at least nominally in power, as they deal with the Trump administration. Let's also call this for what it is. It's out-and-out imperialism. This is the United States basically taking a country for its resources because it can and because it wants to. And I know that this is uncomfortable for many American listeners, but I actually appreciate the vulgarity of this. We have this myth of American exceptionalism, where we are different, where we are sending out these universalizing principles of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Our relationship with Latin America for hundreds of years has not been about that. It's been about taking what we want, putting dictators in place when they serve us, dealing with regimes that are horrible regimes. But if they work with us, we agree to work with them. I won't go through the whole list, but look at U.S. history in terms of relationships with Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Brazil, Argentina, Chile. You can now add, I mean, Venezuela was already on the list. We can add Venezuela to the list. Like, this is what the United States does in the region. And the Trump administration is not pretending any differently. They're not putting a veneer of exceptionalism on it. They're just doing it in a thuggish way. They're saying, look, like, we want to do this. We want to make an example of this country that's been batting its eyelashes at China and Russia, American enemies, that has been expropriating U.S. property, the actions of U.S. companies. Fine, like, let's take it back. So there is a level of just sort of outright cynicism here that I sort of appreciate. Juxtaposed with that is that the Trump administration just pardoned a former Honduran leader who was sitting in the U.S. prison, who himself was a narco trafficker. So this whole thing about how the Trump administration is fighting narco trafficking by doing this, that falls on deaf ears a little bit there as well. On a forecast episode I did with Marco a couple of weeks ago, I threw out there this notion that there would be regime change in both Venezuela and Cuba. That was a forecast I made. And let me just add a caveat that I didn't actually think it was going to happen, and I certainly didn't think it was going to happen this quickly. I put it out there as a forecast because this was something I wanted to monitor in 2026. And for me, forecasts are not predictions. They are a heuristic to think about the world. So the fact that I said that made me focus on information that was coming out of Venezuela and Cuba to track throughout the course of 2026. It's one of the ways I anchor myself methodologically. But I had particularly good timing because a couple of weeks later, we get the domino falling in Venezuela. But my forecast is only half right, because if I'm right, this was all a dry run for Cuba. And I think that the real geopolitical prize here for the U.S. is not Venezuela at all. It is absolutely Cuba. This is one place, by the way, that I am very contrarian. You're going to read a lot about how this is about China in Taiwan, or it's about getting China out of Venezuela. China was already out of Venezuela. They gave up on them years ago. Sure, they would import some Venezuelan oil, but China didn't care about Venezuela. China's doubling down on their trade relations with places like Brazil, like Peru, buying up property and building up infrastructure in some of these places. That's actually, I think, a much bigger threat to the United States in the long term, which this administration is very short-sighted and focusing on something like Venezuela. Russia, sure, they were giving weapons to the Venezuelans, but it seems like the Venezuelans either don't want to or don't know how to use them. And in the meantime, Russia can't even deal with Ukraine. They're going to project power into the Western Hemisphere when they can't even deal with a country that's on their own border, which is much smaller than them and which they should have been able to deal with relatively easily. So I don't buy that Venezuela was this huge geopolitical threat. I think there was a resource opportunity and there was a dry run for what was going to happen eventually with Cuba. Like Venezuela, Cuba's regime has been flashing warning signals about its health for years. You've had inexplicable protests there. You've had hyperinflation. You've had rising costs. You've had shortages of food and medicine. You've had people turning to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies to protect what little they have of wealth there in general. You've got Cubans fleeing the country to try and get out. This is another country where maybe you have a regime or a government or at least a people who are willing to turn their back on the current dictator and on the current system. The fact that Rubio is in position in this Kissingerian role as both Secretary of State and National Security Director, he is the one pushing things here. This is what he wants. This is what he has wanted literally since he took power in the Senate. Like, this is the biggest operating principle for Rubio when it comes to this. And it looks like he has President Trump and the rest of the administration marching to his own beat here. So I would be looking very closely at Cuba going forward. You also zoom out. You may not like this, but there is a coherence to the Trump administration strategy here. They are absolutely doubling down in the Western Hemisphere, and they are looking at critical points of either infrastructure or resources where they need to have U.S. control. So suddenly, the things about Greenland and Trump hotels in Greenland, that shouldn't be a joke anymore. I think that's serious. The threats at the very beginning of the administration to take over the Panama Canal, if Panama didn't play ball, I think that's very real. Now you talk about Venezuela. Now you talk about Cuba. You think about the relationship with Argentina and the Milei government and bailing them out with many billions of dollars and some of the things that upset U.S. farmers and weren't necessarily good for lots of the U.S. But if you're thinking about it from that geostrategic realm, you start to see the coherence of a policy. This is another thing that I want to point out here, though, because, and a couple of weeks ago, Elo was on this podcast, and he'll be back in a couple of days. We talked about the rising right wing ascendant in Latin America, where all of these Trump-style leaders, whether it's in Chile, El Salvador, maybe Peru, maybe Brazil coming, certainly Milei in Argentina. These leaders that are emulating President Trump that want better relations with the United States, you can look out and say, well, wow, the United States actually is lining up these countries, and maybe you are going to get some kind of Latin American integration with Trump leading the way. The thing I want to say about this, though, is that no Latin American leader should feel safe, because once you open Pandora's box, future U.S. governments are going to do this as well for their own ideological reasons. The example I want to give for you of this is go back to the Eisenhower administration and how the CIA really grew up into this organization that was going to foment regime change in places like Iran, which democratically elected a president that the Eisenhower administration didn't like. And so they tried to overthrow him. They did overthrow him. And you get multiple administrations of both parties who use that same playbook, who say we are going to take down leaders if they don't agree with us. And they use the Cold War as the justification for it. But the point I'm trying to make here is that Republicans and Democrats alike use these things for their own ends. They just had different ideologies or a different veneer of ideology on top of it. I don't think AOC is going to win the election next, but if she did, she's not going to roll this back. She's going to do this same kind of thing. She's just going to do it with a different ideological principle or organizing principle. And I think also it opens up a Pandora's box for other dictators in the world, but also other leaders in the world. For instance, probably nobody's going to be brave enough to go after Kim Jong-un, and there's no signs of cracks in the North Korean regime like there have been in Venezuela. But let's say you're Iran. You've just been battered by Israel. You've been embarrassed completely. You've shown that you don't really have any sophisticated air defense to speak of. You already know that there are factions within the Iranian state that are battling with each other. We've seen another bout of protest in Iran recently. Maybe something is going on there. If you're Israel, you're watching this movie in Venezuela and saying, well, why can't we just get some helicopters into Tehran and take out the supreme leader as well? Why doesn't the United States take over management of Iran and its oil resources while they manage some kind of transition to a power there? If you are Lukashenko, the dictator in Belarus, you should be a little bit nervous. What if a European power got enough gumption capacity to do this to you? I'm sure if there are any Polish listeners listening to this podcast and you're on the right in Poland, you're probably thinking about this. I wish I had Jacek in front of me to ask what he thought of this in general. I'm sure that he would be chomping at the bit here as well. If I was Vladimir Putin, I'd be a little bit worried, because we're setting a precedent that you can go after a leader and get them and justify the reason for getting them after the fact. And yes, the United States can do this because it's really, really powerful, but it won't always be so. And this is another thing I want to say about this. I think the U.S. is at the zenith of its military power right now. I think it's all downhill from here. There's been a lot of talk about the Monroe Doctrine and about this Trump corollary that's out there, but let the record show that the first corollary belonged to Teddy Roosevelt. And aside from his corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, another thing that Teddy Roosevelt said was to speak softly and carry a big stick. When Teddy Roosevelt was president in the first age of U.S. imperialism, the United States, yes, it had some misadventures in places like the Philippines and Central America, but it was speak softly and carry a big stick. It was the threat of U.S. military action or the threat of using, weaponizing the U.S. economy against some of these nations that had these nations fall in line. If you have to fire the shot, if you have to go in and take out Maduro, you're actually showing some relative weakness. Even this idea that you have to focus on the Western Hemisphere, that's basically the United States saying we're not powerful enough to do this in the entire world. We need to close ranks, circle the wagons in our own hemisphere, and get powerful here because we can no longer project power in Europe, in Asia, in sub-Saharan Africa. That's not our job anymore. So I think you're really seeing this multipolarity of the world, this breakdown of the expression of U.S. power in the world. And I think this is ironically an example of this in general. The last thing I'll just kind of zoom out and say, this comparison to Taiwan. Is China going to take this opportunity to invade Taiwan? Was this a trade? Did the United States take Caracas? And there's sort of this complicit understanding or implicit understanding, I should say, that, okay, China's going to be able to take Taiwan. I don't think this is how China thinks about the world. Maybe I'll be wrong about this, but I think this changes absolutely nothing about China's posture towards Taiwan. If anything, China looks at the United States and says, this is what a declining late-stage capitalist imperial power looks like. It starts brandishing this big stick all over the place because no one is listening to them anymore. If you want to think about how China thinks about this, look at what they did to Hong Kong. Look at how they politically, technologically, culturally, infrastructurally isolated Hong Kong until the British had no choice but to give Hong Kong back to the Chinese because they didn't care and could not, from a capacity standpoint, defend Hong Kong anymore. That's what China's doing with Taiwan. It is offering China, Taiwan's best and brightest, you know, penthouses in Shanghai, whatever they want, to leave Taiwan to come to the mainland. It is chipping away at the number of countries that recognize Taiwan. It is trying to infiltrate Taiwanese politics, maybe not to get a pro-Chinese leader elected, but to get third parties or other parties that are in the system to make it easier to divide and conquer within Taiwanese politics in general. And yes, of course, they are building up their military so that the threat of military force is credible. All these drills that they're doing in the South China Sea, they're not actually about to wind up for an invasion in the next 12 months. That's practice. And the practice is going to get more and more and more intense as the military gets more and more sophisticated. They're not there yet, but in order for this to happen, they do need to have that credible threat, which they don't have right now. But I think this changes nothing from China's perspective in terms of Taiwan. I think China is operating on a multi-decade timeline when it comes to Taiwan's strategy. It's all about isolating them so that they can absorb Taiwan the same way that they absorbed Hong Kong without firing a shot, even if that means a generation of one country, two systems, which is what China did with Hong Kong for arguably two generations. It was a really wonderful time in Hong Kong's history. And now Hong Kong is adapting in recent years about basically being reabsorbed, about jettisoning this one country, two systems protocol. So I would not take anything from this in terms of China-Taiwan. The thing I would take from China about this is, again, I think China gave up on Maduro and Venezuela years ago. But if you look at what they're doing, what they're building in Peru, their trade relations with countries like Argentina, yes, and Brazil and some of these others, China is expanding its influence in this part of the world. And it's expanding its influence in a way that the United States, at least so far, has not been able to compete with. The United States is brandishing a stick and saying, hey, we can take out a dictator if we want. China's become the top trading partner for most of the countries in South America. It's a much deeper way of integrating into a region. And ironically, the Chinese learned it from the United States, because this was how the United States became not just the power in the Western Hemisphere, but in the world, because the United States was this centrifugal force, this huge economic force that everyone had to deal with. China is slowly supplanting the United States in that context, which is one of the reasons you see the United States resorting to force rather than the threat of force or the threat of economic coercion or even the weaponization of the U.S. economy, whether it's tariffs or sanctions or currency controls, all these other things. It's just not working. So there's a lot here to talk about. We're going to talk more about it with Elo in the coming days. We're going to learn more about it in the coming days. Is this a rehearsal for a war with Cuba? Is this just a one-off? Is it just a crony capitalist regime rewarding energy companies who want to be around in oil? We can ask all these questions, and these are all questions that we're going to ask going forward. But when I look at how the media is reporting about this, you know, it's this pearl clutching, like, oh my God, a precedent has been broken. The Trump administration doing something that's never been done before, and the rules of international order being trampled. Like, give me a break. Like, the United States has been doing this for quite some time. The Trump administration is just not pretending like there's anything noble in this. They're just taking it as they want. And I think ultimately they're not doing it for the good of the Venezuelan people. They're doing it because they have this idea about the Western Hemisphere and about American geopolitics. We can agree or disagree about whether it's the right idea or the wrong idea, but I think it's about that. It's not necessarily about, you know, communicating something to China. It's not about getting China out of the Western Hemisphere. It's about, actually, the U.S. is becoming weaker on a relative basis to some of these other places in the world. We need to make sure that we control the Western Hemisphere. And having a Maduro regime sitting there in Caracas on all this oil and all these resources, who are batting their eyelashes at the Russians and anybody else that wants to come in, that's just not tenable. So make an example of them, take them out, show everyone that the United States military is still very capable, and then you can go out and start to project that power into the Western Hemisphere. I think that is the strategic logic the Trump administration is operating on here. And again, you can agree or disagree with it. This is not the place for me to tell you what's right or what's wrong. I trust my listeners to figure that out for themselves. I will say that from my perch, where I try to be objective, I think that there are some major short-term gains here for the president and for the United States. But I question the logic of this in the long run. I question the logic of using the military when really what's happening here is that economically, this region is becoming less and less dependent on the United States going forward. And the United States can publish as many national security strategies they want, put in as many tariffs as they want, as many currency swaps as they want. They can take out as many dictators as they want. I don't see the United States really turning that around. And that's why I think in the long run, what you're actually doing is you're just confirming for all of these different countries that the United States is not a country to be trusted. And you don't necessarily need trust for foreign policy, by the way. The United States has done very well in the region without anyone having any reason to trust them for centuries. But in a world where U.S. relative power is declining, which is a world I don't think we've really ever existed in, I think the rules of the game are a little bit different. And I think there is a serious dose of short-termism here in the Trump administration. And I would accuse administrations on both sides of the aisle of that short-termism. One of the reasons we're here is the short-termism in dealing with Venezuela going back to the Bush administration. So I hope that is somewhat helpful. I will be trying to put together a more cogent analysis tonight on my Substack. I'm sharing this with you midday Saturday, January 3rd. This is sort of my rough outline. It's the stream of consciousness. I'm going to sit down tonight after the kids go to bed and actually try and type out, okay, what does this mean? What happened here? The serious analysis will come there. But you get to listen into my thoughts here. And if you want a longer conversation about those thoughts, again, you can go to Geopolitical Cousins. If you have not subscribed to the Substack, now's a good time to do that. It's free for now, at least. And I'll be putting some more serious thoughts there as well. So, Happy New Year, right? What a way to start the year. It's a really good time to be a geopolitical analyst. There's good in that for me, but it says that the world is going to be a very volatile place in general. So there's going to be lots of things to analyze, and 2026, we're already off to a quick start. So take care of the people that you love. Turn off the news. Don't watch too much of the news. Try and get some objective sources of information out there, whether it's me or somebody else. Cheers, and see you out there.